1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Take it.
Thank you, Harold. We're going to try to tape record some of this. I have a little tape recorder, and George, or
what is your name?
Harold. Harold has one that he's going to set up. Play these two. All right, we should be recording. I have several publications that I'll be referring to tonight, and one of them is the Soul Newsletter. It's Society Soul Kindred in America. It's a newsletter that started some 15 to 20 years ago, and Colonel John Soul, who is of the branch that split kind of from Spring Lake to Grand Haven, is a and his father was his grandfather was Judge Charles Soul, Judge of Probate, and then his father was Ed Soul, Fayette Soul, who was a son, but we'll get to that a little bit later. I also have a Michigan History magazine. How many people get this particular magazine? And it comes out every 2 months. This happens to be the July and August issue of 1983, and it came in at the most appropriate time. I'm going to be referring to that during my talk. And then, if you'll bear with me, I do have a little genealogy that I'd like to impart, give you some ideas. This goes back quite a long time, and I feel that I'd like to, and I don't want to insult your intelligence, but I'd really like to read portions of this because some of it's interesting, and it's information that it would be impossible for me, I think, to really memorize to present to this group. Remember the saying that you've heard, I'm sure, many times, it didn't originate with me, but if everyone who says they came over, their forebears came over on the Mayflower, it'd have to be as large as the Queen Mary. Well, I'm one of those that will say that, and I believe that I can back that up with the document that I have in my hand. I'm going to go back to George Soul, the Pilgrim, and his wife, Mary Beckett. They had a son, George Soul, and he married a woman by the name of Mary Beckett. It's called One of the Firstborn Children in the New World of the Pilgrims. George Soul, the Pilgrim, came over on the Mayflower, and he came over as an indentured servant. In other words, he was a relatively poor person in England, and in order to get to the New World and start a new life, he indentured himself or sold himself to, I believe it was George Winslow, who was one of the founders of the Mayflower Compact, I believe it was called. And he became a member of that group, came over and worked for the Winslow family for 7 years to become a free man. In the book Saints and Strangers, a copy of it in a local library, and I have not read that copy, but I've read the book in the past, there's reference made to George Soul, who came over on the Mayflower as one of those who came over in indentured status and made a name for himself in the New World. So anyway, even though he came over poor, he got a good start and worked hard, lived a reasonably long life. His will was probated in 1704, and that would be approximately then his date of death. He had a number of children, William, John, Nathan, Deborah, Mary, Lydia, and Sarah. And Nathan is the branch of the family that we are coming down from. Nathan then, the son of George and Deborah, was born in Duxbury, Mass. Before removal to Dartmouth, and the time of his birth is unknown. He married in Dartmouth on June 12, 1704, a woman by the name of Mary Gifford. His name is of frequent occurrence in the record of land surveys and land divisions in the town. He died in Dartmouth, Mass., September 10, 1736, leaving a will in which his heirs were mentioned, proving clearly the line of descent by the names of his children and grandchildren. His children were Timothy, George, John, Content, Mary, and Anne, and George is the one who we trace our ancestry to again. George Soul, son of Nathan and Mary Gifford, was born in Dartmouth, Mass. In 1709, married first in Providence, Rhode Island in 1730 to a woman named Avis Tibbetts, daughter of John and Sarah Soul Tibbetts, his first cousin. Now, if you think that I'm a little bit goofy or anything, that might go back to that generation. Apparently there were no restrictions to do that in those years. Either that or they lost their lineage somewhere. She was from Greenwich, Rhode Island, and inherited her name from Ava Stanton. Her parents were devout Quakers and joined the great wave of emigration and moved to North Carolina. Her father died in Carteret County, North Carolina, April 19, 1755. And if there's an attorney in the group, you might tell me what this means. Leaving a non-cooperative will in which he mentioned his daughter Ava's soul, to whom he gave 2 shillings darling. By his first wife, George Soule had 7 children, 4 of whom were born in Dartmouth, the other 3 were born in Connecticut or in Dutchess County, New York. He was a registered Quaker Society of the Oblong there, that's in Dutchess County. Avis Tibbet Soule died in 1756. George had a certificate of clearance at Swansea, Mass., being styled son of Nathan and Mary Soule of Dartmouth. Now, this is getting kind of long, so I'm going to skip through some of these things, but they are interesting. And I hate not to let you in on some of it, but maybe some of it's not so good, so perhaps I should skip over part of it. It does say here, the records show that he suffered great oppressions from the Loyalists in consequence of his religious faith and his refusal to sign the Oath of Allegiance to King George. Several requisitions were made upon his flocks and herds. He died intestate, and administration was granted of his estate to his son, Nathan Soule, a miller of Pauling, New York, on December 9, 1793. His children were Mary, Content, Alice, Nathan, John, Sarah, Anne, Elizabeth, and Thomas. And we trace our lineage to Nathan. Nathan Soule was the son of George and Avis Tibbet Soule, who I've mentioned before. And we're getting close now to where we should be. Married Sarah Birdsall, daughter of Nathan and Jane Birdsall of Oblong, Dutchess County, New York, in October of 1762. His intention was recorded September 16, 1762. They settled in the vicinity of his childhood home. His name is of frequent occurrence in the county records. I presume that's good and not bad. Well, I'm not sure. He was latterly a miller in Pauling, but no person living can tell the stream on which he located his mill. He sold 250 acres of land in Oblong, New York, to Thomas Briggs in 1773 for £1,085. That sounds like a pretty good sum of money, at least that long ago. It would be about 200 years ago, 210 years ago. This may have been the homestead farm taken up by his father when he first removed from Dartmouth, Mass. To Dutchess County. He was appointed the administrator of his father's property in 1793 and was named the principal creditor. I assume to say that the old gentleman had become enfeebled by age and that his son had sold the old farm and taken his father to live with him in Pauling. Nathan Soule made his will, approved October 4, 1806, then a resident of Pauling. This document indicated that he had considerable property for the times. His carefully worded provision for his maiden sister shows nobility of character. How do you like that? Children, Latin, John, Thomas, Benjamin, Mary, Jane, Elizabeth, Anna, and Sarah. And we trace our lineage to Latin, who apparently is the oldest son. Latin Soule, son of Nathan and Sarah Birdsall Soule, was born in Dutchess County, New York, probably in Oblong in 1763. He married Lydia Leach, daughter of Ephraim Leach of Dover, New York, and lived for several years in that town. About 1819, 1820, he purchased land in the then wilderness Onondaga, New York, and located his home near what was subsequently Clay Corners, some 10 miles from Syracuse. He was a man of good judgment, business ability, and a successful farmer, but his health failed, and for many years he was incapacitated for manual labor. He was tall, slender, and stooping, his features elongated, and his general habits serious and quiet, possibly in part to his physical infirmities. His grandson, Reverend Henry Birdsall Soule, writing of him, says, "There was something venerable in his appearance and manner that commanded respect. His influence, however, derived most of its weight from his goodness of heart and the exemplary character of his life." Sounds just like me, doesn't it? Amazing how that repeats. He was an active member of the Methodist Church and a clergyman who conducted the service at his funeral and eulogized him in the highest degree. He had refused to perform the burial rites of his son because he had made no public profession of religion, this exhibition of bigotry having much to do with making the grandson a Universalist minister. Latin Soul died in 1828, aged 65 years, and left a will containing much genealogical information. Tradition makes him derive his name from the Latin family with which it was supposed his mother was connected. The children in this case, we're getting now down to Benjamin. So my great-grandfather, he's in the low picture against the wall, and his wife Rhoda is over there. The children were Clement, Nathan, Mary, Ambrose, Latin, Ephraim, Leach, Myron, Benjamin B., Sally Ann, Harriet, Demis, and Emdia, and others died young. Now, I don't know how many there were, but that's a pretty good-sized family for any time, not only in those years. And again, we trace our lineage to Benjamin B., Benjamin Birdsall Soul. Now, it gets to be a little interesting, I think, at this point, that this is kind of where the family split, the Spring Lake Souls and the Grand Haven Souls. And I do know that a number of you people here tonight went through the Grand Haven school system. I did the last 2 years of 3 years of high school myself. But I think some of you who had grade school may have had several of the Soul girls for teachers, of Mary Soul and Julia Soul. And they were daughters of Judge Charles Soul. I don't have a picture of him, but I'll make reference to him shortly. Again, we trace our lineage to Benjamin B. Soul. He was the youngest son of Latin and Lydia Leach Soul, born in Dover, Dutchess County, New York, May 20th, 1810. Married his first wife, Matilda Miller, in 1832. She died 1833. He married for his second wife, Rhoda Paddock, sister of his brother Ambrose Latin's wife. She was born April 20th, 1810, and died August 15th, 1883. His first wife was buried in Euclid, Onondaga County, New York. His second wife was interred at Spring Lake, Michigan, as was he. During the time when his brothers, and that's Ephraim Leach Soul, the Leach coming from the mother's side of the family, as I recall, if I read that, yes, Lydia Leach, he married Lydia Leach, daughter of Ephraim Leach, named after the mother's side of the family. I'll start that over again. During the time when his brothers, Ephraim Leach Pat Madison, was having such an extensive sale in the West, Benjamin Soul settled in Ohio, but afterwards removed to Spring Lake, and I'm going to have to fill in some information that's missing in this genealogy that's not quite right, 5 miles from Grand Haven, Michigan. He once met with heavy loss by trusting a worthless fellow as his business partner, but fortunately procured a good dairy farm upon which he acquired a comfortable independence for his venerable years. When he was 84 years of age, he was styled the stiff-necked and rigid old Puritan. He was an ardent prohibitionist during his last years, self-respecting, conservative, close-mouthed, and independent. He paddled his own canoe and asked favors of but few. He and his good wife always enjoyed the respect and esteem of all who knew them. Okay, now, get down to some interesting facts. I hope they'll be interesting to you. I said the Soul family kind of split. Some stayed in Spring Lake, and some came over to Grand Haven. Yes, question? Yes, Judge Soul was my great-grandfather's nephew. It would be this gentleman in a small picture down here. We could, if anyone wanted to take a look at these pictures, you can see, I'll see if you can miss it. This was a man who was born in 1810, it's Benjamin Birdsall Soul. And his wife, Rhoda Paddock Soul, and her sister was married to, I think I know this name, was it Hannah? I'm not absolutely sure of that. But she was married to Ambrose Latin, his older brother. All right, several of the interesting things I can only assume, but I believe that Benjamin Soul was probably closer to his brother Ambrose Latin than any of the other family members. I say that for several reasons. Ambrose Latin Soul is buried over in the Spring Lake Cemetery, and Ambrose Latin was the father of Judge Charles Soul. The Souls from the Grand Haven are buried up in the cemetery on the hill. There are a number of them buried there. I was up the other day and looked at that family plot, and in that, Charles Edward Soul was born 1842, died in 1925. I think in my historical compendium, the book that's open over here, I saw an ad in there, and that's 1893, and I think he was judge of probate at that time, and apparently up until about the time that he died in 1925. I thought it was rather appropriate that I'd be asked to give this talk, inasmuch as our speaker in May was Judge Miles, and he also was judge of probate. It's kind of an interesting thing that one of our family members was also judge of probate for an extended period of time. Some information on Judge Charles Soule. He was a first lieutenant of the 10th Michigan Cavalry. Another interesting note is that Ambrose Latin Soule, his father, was also a captain in Company G of the 10th Michigan Cavalry in the Civil War. And then there was a brother of Charles Edward Soule, and some of you older people might remember him. I don't remember this gentleman at all, but it was James B. Soule, born in 1843. He died in 1928. Obviously, he was from around here because I saw in the museum a chart of Spring Lake Township, and he owned some property up on Fruitport Road that was, well, how far up there? It would be about the location of, well, years ago where Flanders lived and Campbell's lived. Be on the left side of Fruitport Road going north when you hit that big curve on the way to Fruitport. And he owned a number of acres in that area. He also was Sergeant Major of the 10th Michigan Cavalry. So I guess that branch of the Soule family was pretty well represented in the 10th Michigan Cavalry during the Civil War. James B. Soule's wife was Kitty C. Soule. She was born in 1854 and died in 1934. And Judge Charles Soule's wife was Lucinda Saxton Paul, and she was born in 1843, died in 1926. And I don't know anything about her or where she came from, whether he had met her away from the local area or not. I do know that there were some Halls in the Spring Lake area, but I don't know whether that would be of that family or not. Those three children that Judge Charles Soule had then were Edward Soule, who I know some of you remember. I remember him very well. He drove school bus for the Spring Lake school system when I was a very, very small person, which is hard to believe that I was small once, I know. But I really was a little bitty guy, skinny, and much younger, of course. But he died in 1951. And Mary Soule was born in 1869, died in 1948. And Julia was born in 1873 and died in 1945. I noticed that, was it you, Mrs. Bretschneider, did you know any of those people at all? You were saying something.
Yes, I knew the bus driver.
Right.
He had a bus driver.
Yes, I think he did. He was an attorney, but apparently things were not as lucrative for attorneys in those days as they are now. So I think he made ends meet by driving a bus. And yeah, right. Yes. There was another, there were two other daughters in that family, Lila Bidding, Lila Soule Bidding, who died in the mid-30s, 1931. She was born in 1881, died in 31. And I'm sure maybe, Chet, you were in school with one of the Bidding boys, Soule T. Bidding or Jim Bidding, one or the other, not sure. But they were reared by their aunts, Mary and Julia Soule, in Grand Haven. I think that she was living in Evanston, Illinois, at the time she died. There was another sister who I don't have any idea when she died, and she was married, and her name was May Craw. I don't know if anyone knows that name at all. I think that was away from here somewhere, but came back in her last few years of life and lived with Julia and Mary. It may have been that she came to live with Mary after Julia passed on. I don't know, but I visited them sometime shortly before they passed away and had a nice visit with them in my younger years. Another interesting thing, when I had mentioned earlier that the genealogy was not quite right when my great-grandfather moved to Ohio from New York, and then it said moved to Spring Lake near Grand Haven. It was a slight stop that he made between there for a number of years. I don't know exactly the time that he left Ohio, but I assume that it was probably in 1853 or 1854. I do have some old deeds in my possession that show where the property is located in Ohio. The county seat was Chardon, Ohio, which is south and east of Cleveland, and it was in Geauga County, and the property that the deeds show is on the old Chillicothe Road, and the name of the township or the name of the village that he lived was South Russell, and I believe they've dropped the south now, and it's just Russell, and I passed through that area a number of years ago, but never had time enough to stop. It was a white spot in the road, and I didn't need to stop at a white spot at that time. So I didn't stop there saying, hey, I'm going to do that someday. However, they got to Muir, Michigan. That was their interim stop for a number of years. And when I referred to the Michigan history, I opened it up when I got it and was reading through it, and they had a feature in here on Michigan Crossroads Cathedrals. And some of you probably have read this already. But it's most interesting to me, my brother, whose name is Benjamin Linsoll, lives in Corvallis, Oregon. When he was finishing his doctorate at Michigan State University back in 1967, sometime between 64 and 67, he and his wife drove to Muir, Michigan. They were interested in the soul genealogy, and they went through this church, and they told me that the number of windows, however many there were in there, 10 or 12, that all of the windows were dedicated or had names of individuals who had been active in the church. And they said, wouldn't you know, he said, the window that had Ambrose Allen Benjamin on it had the last name broken out and was replaced with a piece of ordinary glass. But we know who it was meant for, so that made all right. But I was interested to read this, and if you'll permit me to read it to you, and when you go home, you can read it for yourself. Muir Church of Christ. On a quiet, tree-shaded hilltop corner stands the older of Muir's two fine 19th century church buildings, the Muir Church of Christ. Gothic in style, the church is clad in gray-painted vertical board and battened siding and has octagonal cluster column buttresses at its corners. Stained glass Gothic windows pierce each of its side walls, and its imposing double-door entrance tower is topped by a cross-gable belfry. Inside, unadorned simplicity contrasts sharply with the grandiose exterior. Flooring of dark stained pine harmonized with cream-colored plaster walls. The center and two side aisles slope gently toward the pulpit. A pressed tin ceiling reflecting a 1906 interior renovation is painted to harmonize with the walls. Scroll arm sofa pews, part of the original 1861 church design, face a raised, dark stained wood pulpit platform. The modern pulpit and corner lamp stands display Gothic paneling. Muir, nestled on the hillsides above the Maple River in northeast Ionia County, today has a population of 700. The Church of Christ has been part of the town since its founding in 1854. That year, the Soul and Robinson Company, a five-man partnership, bought large tracts of land north of the Maple River. Ambrose L. and Benjamin Soul, again referring to his brother, and I feel that they were probably closer than the other members of that family. Robert and A. Byron Robinson and the Reverend Isaac Arrett platted Muir in 1856. All were members of the Disciples of Christ denomination. On 7 September 1856, Arrett became the church's first pastor. 5 years later, at a cost of $3,215.06, the Muir Disciples built their church with lumber shipped from Hubbardston and cut at the Soul Sawmill. Perhaps the most famed guest at the Muir Church was James Garfield of Hiram, Ohio. A friend and co-religionist of Arrett, lay preacher Garfield spoke at the Muir Church in 1862. In September 1881, Arrett delivered the principal oration at the funeral of assassinated President Garfield. I think that's an interesting piece of history. It kind of ties in with my family a little bit. Kind of nice. It kind of makes goose pimples rise in my face and my neck area, I guess. An interesting thing to me, and please accept this in the way it's meant. Everything that might be interesting to me is certainly is not interest you. I realize that, but some of the things that do interest me, I hope that will interest you too. I had found an old photo album in my mother's house across from the country club property in Spring Lake a number of years ago. Everything that people in the Soul family never had any use for anymore always went up in the attic of that house. So it was a veritable storehouse of treasures, really. Well, I'd call them treasures. A lot of it was junk, I'll have to admit. But at any rate, this photo album was very interesting. However, as most people who take pictures never identify what the pictures were, here was an album with beautiful pictures in it, and the only ones who I could identify were the people that I really knew from other pictures and who they were. So my Uncle Carl, who died in 1976, the oldest member of my father's family, was 96 years old, and he, like myself, apparently was interested in soul history, family history, and so he imparted a lot of things to me that I probably have forgotten most of, but I was interested in the same way that he was. And when I found this photo album, I brought it out and asked him, and he said, "Oh, yes," he said, "that's old Reverend Arrett, or Preacher Arrett." And I said, "Well, who was he?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "He was a friend of old granddad's." And I said, "Well, where?" And he said, "Well, I think maybe in Muir." He said, "He came to our house here, and this is him, I remember that." But he never knew. Well, anyway, in reading this article, it was most interesting to me to find out that he was founder, along with Ambrose and Benjamin, of Muir, Michigan, and was the first pastor of that particular church in Muir. And then going on to find out that, in addition to that, he had the president-to-be, Garfield, deliver that address when they dedicated the church, apparently, and then that Garrett was chosen for the principal oration at the assassinated President Garfield's funeral. I thought that was very, very interesting. I wanted to go back to this, and I don't remember just what I wanted to go back to it for, but, oh yes, I do. When I said the Soul Family, this Soul Kindred newsletter was really founded by Colonel John Soul. He retired from the Army. That's another branch of the Armed Forces of the United States, the Army. I happen to be in the Air Force, but that is another branch. A little older, but probably not as good. The lineage on their family is identical to ours, except when it comes after Latin Soul. Ambrose Latin Soul was the father of Judge Charles, and then Charles Soul, Fayette Soul, was the next branch, and Colonel John Soul was his son. And then the 11th generation after the original George Soul, who came over, Pilgrim George Soul, was Linda Soul Preston. There's a little article in here. John Soul passed away about 3 years ago. This particular issue was one announcing a welcome to Cincinnati for the Soul Kindred Reunion. They have one every year, usually in September. The year prior to this, I think they met at Plymouth, Massachusetts. And someday, I hope maybe I'll have an opportunity to go there and find out what goes on at one of those reunions. But John Soul died. He left 10% of his estate to Soul Kindred in America, and has helped them to, I guess, make ends meet and continue to be a good organization. This newsletter comes out quarterly. And I've been getting it for about 15, or maybe close to 20 years, about the time it was started. I guess probably that in addition to what I've said about this whole family over here and what I've said about our branch in Spring Lake, I could say a few other things. I wanted to try, well, I didn't want to have this go too long because I don't want you to fall off the chair. If anybody starts nodding, I'm going to come over and shake you. But I wanted to mention my mother's family. It was kind of an unusual situation. When my Uncle Carl, again the eldest son in my father's generation of our family, went away to school, he went away to Kalamazoo College, and it was rather unusual in the 1890s for anyone to go to college. So it was most unusual, I'm sure, for him to go. And he went to Kalamazoo College in Kalamazoo, Michigan, as many young people did in those years, and perhaps you have relatives who did the same thing. People, when they left this area, I know I spent a number of years in North Dakota, and they said their greatest export in North Dakota was their young people. They'd export them everywhere out of the U.S. to get them out of North Dakota. Well, I think the same thing may have happened in the Tri-Cities area during those years. Same thing, my father did that, left Spring Lake when he was about 14 or 15 years old, went into Chicago. And my Uncle Carl, the oldest brother, who was born in 1879, left. He never really came back to Spring Lake after he went to Kalamazoo. He went into Chicago for summer employment. And the job that he was able to get was at the stockyard in Chicago, which was an enormous thing in those years and was not even in existence now. But he got a job there, and because he'd had a little college, he ended up as timekeeper to a man named John Lynn. And John Lynn was an old country Swede, had come over from Karlskoga in Värmland back in 1879 or 1880, something like that, and had worked his way into a job at Swift & Company and had what I presume was a fantastic job in those years. He was in charge of all the ice house gangs and so forth. They'd spend the winter cutting ice up in Fox Lake, Illinois, and Lake Geneva and some of those areas, and they'd ship ice back to the city of Chicago in boxcars, you know, trainload after trainload. And my Uncle Carl, who worked at the yards for a number of years for him as his timekeeper, had said that they had an ice house that was a block square and was 7 or 8 stories tall, and that must hold a lot of ice. But at any rate, he ended up being his timekeeper, and as people will talk to each other, he said, "Well, boy," he said, "John, you should come out and see where I came from in Spring Lake, Michigan." And so he said, "Well, maybe I should." So he ended up coming out here in about 1896 or 1897, and apparently stayed at the Soul House, which is on the site of the Spring Lake Country Club now. And there are 2 pieces of property for sale. If all of you are familiar with Fruitport Road and Bowen Bridge now, Petty's Bio, 2 pieces of property just north of Bowen's Bridge, one on the east side of the road, one on the left side of the road, and he could have bought either piece for the same amount of money. The reason he chose the one that was on the east side of Fruitport Road and ran from Petty's Bio up to Kelly Street or Kelly Road was that it was like where he came from in Sweden, and his idea was to bring his father over and put him to work on that land because he was an expert in, as much as people could be experts in those years, in tilling the soil and marshy, low-lying land. Well, he never got him over. He died too soon, fortunately for the old man, I'm sure, because it would have been a back-breaking job. But he chose that piece of property rather than the one on the other side. He bought that for $2,000. He could have had the one on the other side, where we now live, for $2,000, and roughly the same acreage, 90-some acres involved. And he made a choice on that side, and rightly so. But if we would have taken the choice on the other side, I think maybe we'd be wearing a few diamonds or something like that. But at any rate, that's a choice that he made at that time. Another thing that is kind of interesting, I think, my Uncle Carl, who I would talk to whenever he came back for a vacation, said as a lad he remembered when Indians were in the Prospect Point area, where the Prospect Point condominiums are located now. And he can remember when the Indians would come there in the spring or summer or fall, sometime of the year, and they'd weave baskets and a few other things. My father remembers there was an Indian that was living somewhere back out in the back 40 somewhere, back where they lived. And he would come to the house when he was just a lad, when my father was just a very young boy, and would be asking for food and handouts of some type. But that seems a far cry. Instead of coming to someone's back door, they come to the county building up over there now for that type of thing. But at any rate, that was one of the first social programs they had, I'm sure, in the U.S., and my grandparents and great-grandparents were involved in that. So anyway, there's another item that my wife wanted me to tell a story, and I've forgotten what the story was. Oh, haven't I told about these folks?
No.
Oh, all right. I can go on from there. All right. This is Cassie Margarita Borjesson-Sola. She was an old country Swede, came from the same place my grandfather Lynn came from. I guess I could go back one step and go back to the Lynn heritage. My grandfather's name was really Lindblad, L-I-N-D-B-L-A-D. And coming over on the boat, he met a group of young men who had been in this country working in Chicago and had gone back to Sweden to see their folks and came back. And he was only 13 years old. And so they kind of took him under their wing. And he was on his way to Red Wing, Minnesota to see relatives. He was going to go to a relative, a cousin or something. And they said, John, he said, you don't want to go to Red Wing, Minnesota. You come to Chicago with us. And I would imagine if I was in that situation, I'd probably do the same thing that he did. When somebody showed a little interest in taking me to a good boarding house in Chicago, I'd probably go with them too, rather than go to Red Wing, Minnesota. We have no idea who those people were in Red Wing, Minnesota. I think the Swedes are notorious in not following up family. It must be, because my mother was telling me an incident that happened in the 30s. On a Sunday afternoon, she saw a car drive into my granddad's house, her father's home, which is just 100 or 200 yards from where we live. And so the next morning she said, who was that that drove in your yard? And he said, oh, that was my cousin. And he said, your cousin? Yeah, my cousin. Well, where is she from? He said, well, from Whitehall. And, well, what's her name? And I think the name was Olson, but he made no effort to track her down, follow it. So you lose track of people that way. And I'm sure that's not only so in our family, but everyone's family, the same thing happened. But to get back to Cassie, of course, my mother was a Lynn, Ruth Lynn, and my father was a Soul. And so by virtue of my Uncle Carl having gone to Chicago out of Kalamazoo College and getting a job for who was to be my grandfather at one time, they ended up marrying each other and, of course, lived happily ever after. And you see what they produced. I have a brother and a sister that are even better than I am. My grandfather, Fred, and then in the smaller oval pictures are my father, his brother, and mother in the middle of this picture on the left, and his two sisters, Rhoda and Eva, and the other picture just before it showed my father on this side, Rhoda them on the back. She passed away in 1969. Eva passed away the 1st December 1968, and they died in reverse order from what they were born. Carl was born in 1879. He died the last. Rhoda was born next. She died next to last. Eva, who was the third born, died second. My father, who was first born, or the last born, died first. So he died in 57. And those things. And I guess that as far as they're concerned, my Aunt Eva was a Vandermeiden, married a man by the name of Peter Vandermeiden, who was from Grand Haven, whose father was Joe Vandermeiden. They lived down on Polk Street across from Keefe's Celery Field. He had a sister, Jeanette, and I'm sure that some of you people who attended the First Reformed Church would know Jeanette. And Winnie, her name, married Arvid Colson. Let's see, Kamerads, how are the Kamerads related to... Oh, yeah. Art Kamerad married, what was her? Alice Vandermeiden Kamerad. Right. So anyway, that part of the family was there. My Aunt Rhoda was a maiden lady, never did marry. And Aunt Macaro was married but never had any children. So my dad had three children, and so we're the only ones in our family. But we've done very well. Right now, I have five children, three boys and two girls. My brother has three boys and one girl. My sister has three boys and one girl. So anyway, we're trying to keep, my brother and I are going to keep our name alive for a while, yeah, I believe. The artifacts I have here, the 1893 compendium of Ottawa County. There's a copy of this in the museum. I know I saw it down there. And perhaps Gertrude someday, if you want to go in and take a look at it, I'll let you read through it. The portion that I was going to refer to in this compendium is on page 69, and it covers Ottawa County. It says, Shirley Hammond was one of the early settlers of Spring Lake in Ottawa County. He located a farm now occupied by Benjamin Soul in 1840. He was struck and killed by a locomotive near the depot about 1874. It is supposed that he buried between $3,000 and $4,000 in a tin box upon his lot, now occupied by Lewis Fiedler's saloon, just a short time before he was killed. How do you like that? Good fables. Anyway, I think that Fiedler's saloon was located about where Clyde Keefe's office is in the village of Spring Lake, if I'm not mistaken. Although a thorough search was made, neither box or money was ever known to have been found. then it goes down in a paragraph and says, Benjamin Soule was born in 1810 in Ohio, which is an error. He was born in Dutchess, New York, and within 7 miles of the old Garfield home. And the late President Garfield was a young man. He worked at carpenter work one summer just across the road from Mr. Soule's home, and at that time little expected to hold the high positions he afterwards held in the nation's affairs. And it's just filled with all types of things. George Seagrove came to Spring Lake, George Lovell, where he located, J. McClure, an old Spring Lake family, the Purims, who Clinton knows very well, mentioned in here, DeWitts, Warner Voss, Walter Sinclair, Alexander Wood, Manley Patchen, the Shoemakers, Martin Walsh, J. O. Bates, C.P. Brown, George Perry, George Schwab, Alois Bills, who was my father's guardian, by the way. Alois was the original Bills family that came to Spring Lake. When my dad's father passed away, my father was still a minor, and he was an appointed guardian of my father. His two sisters, brother, were old enough, so they didn't need a guardian. I do have an annual accounting in my possession from Alois Bills, my father's guardianship, and it was it's kind of pitiful in a way to read it. It was written out longhand, and I suppose everything was longhand in those days. Didn't have any computers, as you know, to run these things off then. But wrote out, and I can only recall briefly, I should have looked that up, I presume, but a pair of shoes, $2, a shirt, $1.50, and his annual accounting was like $6 or something like that to take care of my father. I know what the story was that I wanted to tell you. If you take a look at my grandmother Cassie, she looks rather stern, high cheekbones, and I guess for want of a better word, I probably shouldn't use the word reprobate, but I kind of believe that she may have been somewhat of a reprobate. She didn't have a very good name in Spring Lake, I know that, and I know why, I think, and I'll tell you why, but I think you've got to remember that her husband died. And I think it's, in those years, it was kind of commonplace for people to try to run over somebody. Now, Clinton knows my grandmother, and he would probably verify, he'd probably say, oh, she was a fine woman. But if you got him alone, he'd probably say, no, she was just exactly what you said she was. But at any rate, back in 1916 or 17, there was no road at the north end of the Spring Lake Cemetery going down into Villa Park, Coles Park, and Strawberry Point area. And so during those years, 1900, 1902 or 3, the Interurban coming from Grand Rapids came up across the Soule property, now the Country Club property. There was a cemetery crossing. There was a crossing called Welsh's Crossing in Spring Lake, which was at 104 and Fruitport Road, and then some of the other stops I can't name, but I do know those two crossings. People would come from Grand Rapids. The means of transportation from Grand Rapids to the cottages in Villa Park and Coles Park, Strawberry Point, was then across the Country Club property or down State Road and across the Soule property. My grandmother was really didn't want people to use that property to go across anywhere but there. And so she would do the best that she could as a widow and an old lady, and would string barbed wire across there and put up no trespassing signs and that type thing, to try to protect her property. In addition to that, she'd sit on the front porch with a shotgun. She had a lot of apple trees and an orchard kind of around her old house in the field, and kids from Villa Park would be in there in the apple trees and climbing around and stealing her apples and breaking the limbs off the tree and just giving her fits, you know. So every once in a while, she'd blast off with a shotgun. One day while she was sitting on the porch, she noticed a lot of activity down at the corner of Beach Drive, at the northeast corner of the new cemetery in Spring Lake. And she thought, well, my goodness, what's going on down there? She hot-footed it down there, and she ran into the supervisor of Spring Lake at that time, and his name was Dave Klein. I'm sure probably some of you people remember that name. And she said, well, Mr. Klein, what are you doing? And there were teams of horses in there, and they had these old board scrapers and so forth, and they were putting a road through there. He said, well, lady, I said, we're putting a road through here. She said, you're what? And he said, we're putting a road through here. She said, you're not putting any road through here. And she hopped on her bicycle and went to Grand Haven, where we are, and got an injunction issued against them, and they had to cease and desist. Came to court, and the Swanson family has been intertwined with our family for a number of years, so intertwined, in fact, that I married a Swanson just 3 years ago. Now that's another story, but I better not get into that. Not that I married her 3 years ago, but the Swanson family and the relationship between them. But when it came to trial, they all testified, and I think it was Alfred Swanson who was on the stand at the time, and someone asked him, "Well, can you tell me, were there any signs up there or anything indicating that that was not a thoroughfare?" He said, "Oh, yeah," he said, "they were always up there. We'd always tear them down, go on across, and they're just in the way." He said, "Case dismissed." So rather than being able to put the road through and not having to pay for it, they were able to put the road through, but they paid the magnificent sum of $600 for that 25-foot of right-of-way that they had originally from Fruitport Road into Villa Park and Coles Park and Strawberry Point area. Well, anyway, I guess I take with a grain of salt in some ways that my grandmother was that way. In other ways, I think she probably had to be that way to protect her property. It's nice to know that somebody is willing to stand up and be counted. She wasn't so well-liked in those years, but anyway, I think she had a change of heart in her latter years, and I can recall as a very, very young person, probably 8 or 9 years old, that it was a real treat to go to her house. She knew that my dad loved potato pancakes, and so she would have us over for potato pancakes. And all she had to cook on was one of those kerosene stoves, and so that must have been a real chore for her. She died in 1934 and was laid rest in Spring Lake Cemetery next to her husband, Fred, who was on the same plot on the old Spring Lake Cemetery.